Jason won that match against Shane, and Shane's a king, and he went up and stood in his chair. You don't stand in the king's chair.
Welcome back to another episode of the Cue It Up podcast. I am excited to be joined this week by some of the probably most legendary cue makers of Wisconsin over the last, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years. Jacoby Custom Cues by both David Jacoby and Brandon Jacoby. So how are you guys doing?
Hey, not too bad. It's nice to be on the podcast, Nate. I've been enjoying listening.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, Brandon, I finally got you listening to it. It took almost a year, but you finally figured out how to use your phone, and you got the podcast, so thanks for listening now.
yeah, thanks.
And you've been a sponsor for the last year as well, so I will thank you for that.
Yep, no problem. I appreciate everything you're doing, so.
We can start this interview off with a question for Dave, and because Dave, you started this company back in sometime at some point when you're about to tell us. What was the inspiration for starting the company, and basically, why'd you do it?
Oh, well, I started back about 1982, and back then I was playing a lot of pool, and there was a fellow in town that his name was Big Ears, and he put the tips on for all the players. And he passed away. After he passed away, his wife called, and because I'd been to his house so many times, it got tips put on, and said that now that Big Ears had passed away, there was nobody in town left to put tips on for the players, and said if I would be interested, she would give me his equipment, and I could put tips on for the guys that they played with. And I thought about it a while, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. So that's how I started. And I guess when I went up and to get his equipment was all in a cigar box and consisted of a tube of glue, a box of tips, some rubber bands, and some sandpaper. And that's what his equipment was, and that's what I started with.
Pretty high-tech material there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It took a while to catch on to it, but I persevered, I guess.
So how did something like that with, you know, a rubber band and some glue and some sandpaper, how did that transitioning to building cues?
After I started putting the tips on, then I actually bought a, way back then, one of these Willard tip tools. And I started doing that. And I started selling Viking cues, Mucci's, McDermott's, all different brands. And one day, Gordy Hart called me and said, Dave, I got a lathe here. It's the lathe that I started with. And he says, I don't no longer need it. He says, if you're interested in buying it, he says, I know you do a lot of repairs. He says, you can get it. He says, and you can even build a cue on it if you like. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And me and my oldest son, Shane, he was 16 at the time, and he was kind of helping me out a little bit. So we went down and we bought it and started messing with it, and that's how we started. And I still have that lathe to this day. I've used it almost every day for 40 years. I've used that lathe. We use it up in the finish room now for polishing and stuff. But otherwise, that's what I started making my cues on. The lathe that Gordy Hart at Viking started with is the same lathe that I started with.
Wow, that's a pretty impressive lathe. That lathe has seen some stuff.
Yeah, and at that time I paid $1,000 for it. Now, this is close to 40 years ago. And if you look at that lathe today and you say, you paid what for that? Yeah, we bought it home. Shane and I, we went down and got it. We bought it home, and the wife come down and looked at that, and that's exactly what she said. You just paid $1,000 for that? but I've used it every day for 40 years. So it's like that little aid doesn't owe me nothing.
It seems like you may have gotten your money's worth out of it.
As a kid, too, when they first got the lathe set up down in the basement, how excited Dad and my brother were to start puttering around with building cues. I think Shane had taken his old McDermott he played with at the time and tried hacking it up. And
but that's what we do. We take old cues and stuff, broken cues and stuff, and cut them apart and see how they were made, and went from there. And one thing led to another, and then just through the years, it just kept getting busier and busier. Till finally, I think it was 1998, I quit the mill just to do the cues full time. And everybody thought I was crazy at the time for doing it. And after I did it, I kind of thought I was too, but it all worked out.
I would say it worked out pretty well for you.
Yeah. So
we can switch over to a question for Brandon now. Not trying to age you or anything, Brandon, but you would have been a pretty young boy, I'm thinking, maybe in your like 10 or somewhere around 10 years old when your dad got the lathe. Do you remember him bringing it home and setting it up and trying it out for the first time?
I do. I remember when they first got it and watching him and Shane both excited to build cues and taking bar cues and cutting them up and make a lot of fire pokers at the time, because my mom would always laugh about it because they would try this and try that. And there was really no one-stop shop to learn how to build cues or even really to buy parts to build cues. So it was really taking things that they could find off of existing cues and changing them around. But yeah, I remember sitting on the steps to our basement and watching Shane and Dad both, work away down in the basement.
So you do a lot of the cue building to this day, if I'm not mistaken. When did you start getting the itch to kind of take over the family business and build cues yourself?
Well, it wasn't until I was probably 15 that I really started to take an interest in even in playing pool. I mean, I'd been around it most of my life, but I didn't really have much of an interest in playing. I'd play down in the basement once in a while, and I'd watch my dad and my brother play quite a bit, but I really didn't have too much interest. But once I had turned 15, I had made some friends in Nakusa, and we started to play a lot down in Chris's basement at the time, and his dad would always come down and whoop up on us all the time. And then I just really started to get the itch because I really wanted to beat his dad. So I'd practice so I could try and come back and beat him. And then once I got the itch, I was hooked. Then I would just play like every day. I'd play 4 or 5 hours. I'd get home from school and I'd just play pool. And I really didn't have much of an interest in building cues, but I was interested in the idea of, the business. And I think it was once I had graduated high school, I was really thinking about going into the criminal justice, and I wanted to become a police officer. And Dad had suggested that I stay in town and go to the local tech school and then also work part-time in the shop. And then that's when I really started to work in the shop. And then I started to really get the bug to build cues. And I think that was kind of the catalyst to, really take the business forward, because before that, it was just really Dad kind of puttering in the shop. And once I started working in the shop more full time, that's when things really started to take off. And it seemed like it was a possible full time business. And then at that time, Shane Walker, a friend of mine, he still works. A lot of people know Shane from over the years, but he started with me about the same time. And then it was just Shane and myself working in the shop.
And put a year on this. When about was this?
It was about 1993.
About 1993. So basically from 1993 to, I guess, 2020 now, you guys have built this up to being, you're not like the biggest cube maker in the country, but you're going to be pretty hard pressed to go into any real pool hall in the entire country, maybe even, you know, the most of the world, and find somebody that has never heard of Jacoby Custom Cues. That's a pretty respectable thing that you guys did in that amount of time.
Yeah, it's been a lot of work. I mean, I remember over the years from when we first started and what it took to get it to this point. It's certainly hasn't been an easy road, but it's been a good trip, though. You know, we spent a lot of time, you know, traveling and again, you know, just trying to learn just from hard knocks. You know, I remember as a kid, I would tag along when we go to the trade shows, like the BCA show and stuff. And I remember Dad always trying to pick everyone's brain to get any little tidbit of help or ideas on how to do things different. And but yeah, it's pretty amazing that we've gotten this far.
Yeah. So I'll ask a question for both of you, but I'll ask it to Dave first. In all of the years of your building cues, what are there any cues that have stood out to you as, you know, this is the one cue that I enjoyed the most building, or, you know, maybe this is the one that stuck with me the most through all of these years?
Probably I would say the ones that I built for the one that actually there was two of them, and they were both related. One was a Vietnam cue that I built for Keith Walton. And after I had built it, they did a little article on it in Billiard Digest, and a fellow called me, and he had seen it and asked me if I would make another one. And I said, I can't make another one because it was a one of a kind I had made for Keith. And I said, but I can design something similar and change things and make it different. And all this, and he says, well, let's do that. So I spent quite a bit of time with him, and we designed up another Vietnam cue. And after we got all done, we settled on a price, and he says to me, he says, how soon can you have it done? And I says, well, I says, at that time, I think we were quoting about 6 months or something. And he says, well, I'd appreciate it if you could get it done within 8 weeks. He says, I have terminal cancer and I only have 8 weeks to live. And I thought, oh my God. And he was a Vietnam veteran, and we had spent, you know, as we were designing, you spent quite a bit of time, talking about Vietnam and stuff like that. So I says, well, I'll get it done for you. And as I was doing it, a friend of his would call me every once in a while and say, hey, Dave, he says, Fred is down in the dumps. So give him a call. So I'd call Fred up, and we'd BS about Vietnam and stuff like that. And we got it done. But that was probably one of my most memorable ones, just from the way it happened. And he got the cue in time, and he passed away, unfortunately, a week after he got it. And his buddy called and said that was one of the happiest things he'd ever seen when he opened that box up and got that cue. So that's one of my probably most memorable cues.
Wow, that's some pretty powerful stuff. Was he able to hit any racks with it, or was he too far along?
Yep. His buddy said he got to shoot some racks with it, and he said when his buddy opened that box up, he actually cried. Oh, and he got to play with the Vietnam cue, and that's all he could think about doing.
That is some pretty powerful stuff. I'm glad to hear that he got to hit a couple racks with it too. That's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Brandon, I don't know how it's possible to follow that up. Good luck.
Yeah, I can't. I can't. But probably, I think for me, over the years, some of the favorite cues that I have built are the most memorable. There's been a couple cues that I had built for the Cue of the Year through the American Cue Makers Association that kind of stand out just for myself, just in my own appreciation for, you know, the design. We built a cue based off of the Taj Mahal, and that was probably the personally one of the best cues I think I've ever built. And then just, I think for that cue, it was really just the different elements that I put into it. And then, of course, there was the Peacock cue that was actually probably my personal favorite. And I actually got to play with it for a couple of years until Dad sold it on me at a show.
Good work, Dave. So, you ruin everything.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it was funny because when I pulled the cue off the shelf, it was sitting on the shelf, and I liked the colors. It was everything about it I really liked. And when I took it off the shelf, I said, "Dad, I said I think I'm going to play with this cue." He says, "Well, you know, Brandon, if anybody wants to buy that cue, you've got to sell that cue." I said, "Okay, I'll sell it if somebody wants it. You know, we're in the business of selling cues." But you know, I played with it for 2 years, and then he's at the BCA national tournament, and he calls me up and he says, "Brandon, like, I think I got your cue sold."
Thanks, Dad.
So by the end of the show, he had sold it. Well, then the next show, I said, "Well, you know, Dad," I said, "your cue, if I get somebody to buy that cue, you got to sell that cue." he just mumbled. He was like, "Oh, yeah, whatever." So that next show, I sold this cue on him.
You have a dirty dog.
that's awesome. That's well, that's a decent follow up to the story. That's pretty funny. there's a million places I want to take the interview from here, but I guess I would say this: there is no good cue maker in the entire world that is able to have a nice cue, because once they have a nice cue, it's sold that like right then and there. So you guys are following right along with that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You're
yeah.
constantly changing cues, because right when somebody, you know, sees your cue and it catches their eye, you gotta sell it.
Yep.
So, Brandon, we'll go back a little bit, and you had mentioned that you build Cue of the Year for the American Cue Association, and I don't think we can leave that there, because your guys' success in this is probably unmatched in the entire billiard world in the world. Like, anywhere. So you have now built, you guys have now been partaking in this for over 10 years, if I'm not mistaken on that.
Oh, I think it's 14 years this year.
Yeah. So 14 years. And tell us a little bit about your finishes in those 14 years.
So in the 14 years, we've either taken first or second 13 of the 14 years.
Which is insane.
Yeah, with the cues that we've submitted. And I think really the American Cue Makers Association is really what's kind of pushed us ahead, like made us really work hard to try and improve our craft. Because when you go to those shows and you sit down, it's intimidating. When you look around the room and there's so many great cue makers and so many cool ideas and things that are out there, and it just kind of pushes yourself to try and do it better. And that competition, it's really pushed us just even in our own, well, especially for me, and just my own technical ability and learning new techniques and coming up with new ideas. And so it's really been a good experience for us over the years.
And I can't leave it there, because some of the cues that you guys make are just, I mean, they're breathtaking. They're the gorgeousness that goes into these cues, the intricacies, the colors, the patterns. It's absolutely insane. And if you haven't, I mean, everybody listen to this podcast. This podcast sucks. You don't want to listen to us. Go over to the Jacoby Custom Cues and look at their entries for the cue of the year. I mean, they're just stupid how just absolutely gorgeous they are. They are something that you have to see. But so you don't want to look at the price tags, is basically what I'm going to be getting at. What is the most expensive cue of the year that you guys have ever had and then sold for?
The Shaka Zulu cue we sold for $35,000. And they've all been ranged in price over the years, I think anywhere from $10,000 to $35,000. And I think, you know, one of our keys to our success in that we've tried to theme every cue that we've submitted. So, and I've worked really hard to try and come up with interesting ideas and designs that say the theme, but unless if you specifically know the theme, you might not put it all together. But once you understand what the theme is, then all the different elements of the cue kind of tell a little story. We did probably the most famous queue that we've ever built was the Ronin queue, the samurai queue. And that was an interesting queue because the joint and the butt cap, we used a metal called Mokumegane. It's a Japanese metal where it's a blend of copper, silver, and it looks like wood-grained metal. And then we used an acid material to etch it. And then the extension, we did a silk cord wrap, like a handle of a samurai sword, and it was wrapped over a red stingray leather wrap. I did little rising suns on the joint protectors, and that was probably one of the most talked about cues I think that we've ever built. But every cue that we've done for that, we've done different themes. The Shaka Zulu cue was an African themed cue. I did one on the Roman Empire.
Gladiator.
Yeah, the gladiator cue.
The Celtic cue. That one was one of my favorites.
Yep. And then we did another one on a Fabergé egg. The Taj Mahal.
There was an Egyptian one, right?
Yeah, we did an Egyptian themed cue.
That one was my favorite. That one was stunning. That one had correct me if I'm wrong, that had actual gold inlays in it too, right?
It did. It had a very thin, there were 0.004 of an inch thick that ran up the sides of the points. And I think Jerry Lempe has that cue, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
So definitely, if the listeners out there, you got to get over there and you got to check out the past entries for that. They're absolutely stunning, and you guys, every single year, you guys put an entire year into building one queue to be able to submit to that every year. It's crazy the amount of work that you guys put into it, but it shows up in the beauty of the queue.
Yeah, we usually spend about 200 hours per queue, 200 to 300 hours of shop time, from the initial design concept all the way through to the end.
Yeah, and most of those are in the last week, right?
Well, yeah, of course.
We usually end up polishing the shafts the day before we leave.
It takes a long time to make these cues. There's a lot of curing time that goes into those things.
Yeah, it does. Like the Ronin cue, like, or all these cues, we can spend 6 to 8 weeks just cutting parts to do the inlay work, or that someone is just cutting pieces for it. So, I mean, it takes a long time.
Yes. So we can transition from there. And we're talking about like the insane amount of engineering that goes into your cues of the year, but you guys also put a lot of that engineering time into your actual cues as well. I mean, you're just your standard cues. You guys do make a cheaper line of cues, but predominantly your cues are higher end custom cues. You're not pumping out like $57, you know, run of the mill Walmart cues. You guys are putting out a really high quality pool cue for somebody who takes the game seriously. So why don't you talk a little bit about basically what you learned from creating those queue of the years and how you incorporate that into your everyday queue that you sell as, you know, just your line queues.
Okay. So some of the construction, methods we can transition over into queues for customers. Also a lot of the different inline techniques to create different patterns we can transition over into customer queues. So for example, on the queue that we're building for this year's competition, now they've canceled it, so hopefully it'll happen sometime this fall, but there was an inlay pattern that I used in the dead center of the queue that Kevin Neuberger had contacted me about having a custom made queue for him. And he's in a wheelchair and he plays out of the wheelchair, and he wanted a design in the butt sleeve of the queue that was someone in a wheelchair and it had flames coming off the backside. And I could use the technique that I just developed and worked out for the queue of the year. I used it to be able to accomplish that inlay pattern for him. So a lot of the techniques that I pick up and learn, it just
you know, just helps me become a better cue maker. But most of the cues that we build for specific individuals that come to me with the design. Majority of the cues that we build are one of a kinds and custom cues. And we've really pushed hard to use different materials that aren't typically seen within the industry. And I think that's one of the areas that we've strived really hard on, to try and think outside the box, because there's so many different cue makers that are in the market already, and it's really hard to come up with your own style, you know, a cue that you can see across the room and say, well, that's a Jacoby. And I think we've done really well in that respect. And all the cues, we core all the cues, everything is threaded together and epoxied. You know, we season all the materials in the shop, so everything gets staged cut from when we bring the pieces in the shop. You know, it takes about a year for some of the materials from the time we get it in the shop until it comes to the final product. So just the process that we put every cue through takes about 9 months, even if we weren't behind. And then we've also worked hard to come up with new ideas for technology with the shafts. Like our ultra shaft, our black shafts. And over the years, that's been a big change in the market as well. It's just the idea of low deflection shafts. And so we've also stayed focused on that as well.
Dave, did you have anything to add to that? I shouldn't.
No, that pretty well sums it up. I think it's, yeah, that's pretty much what our focus has been on. It's like I always said, you know, through the years, all the sports have gone to composites and stuff, tennis, bowling, all of that. But pool shafts always stayed maple. So what happened is everybody re-engineered the maple to play it better with all the display shafts, low deflection shafts, and things like that. But now that Predator has come along and introduced the carbon fiber, and it seems to have caught on, that it seems to be transitioning into the composites now, into the carbon fiber. So we've been working hard on that and putting a lot of time and a lot of effort into it and to come out with a really, really good product.
Yeah, and I do have two Jacoby Black shafts. Everybody who listens to the podcast obviously already knows that. But, yeah, I shoot with a Jacoby Black shaft. So I think, Brandon, that was a really good transition into the next direction that I wanted to take, which is it's kind of the future of Jacoby and where you guys are going from here. I mentioned this before the beginning of the podcast, and you had kind of said something that I didn't know, and it's kind of a big transition. For the last, since 1982, if you got a Jacoby custom cue, the signature that you saw on that cue was David Jacoby's, right?
Yes. Yep. Only unless if somebody specifically requested my signature, it always gets Dad's signature. So we always kind of joke because Dad owns 51% of the company and I own 49% of the company. So as long as he's got those extra 2%, he can continue to put his signature on them.
And
he's only flexed that 2% muscle only once or twice over the years, but
kind of funny. One day his desk is right next to mine in the office here, and this was a while back, and just out of the clear blue one day, Brandon turns around and says, "Dad, I'd like to buy 2% more of the company. Would you sell it to me?" No, I think I'll hang on to 2%. But now I just turned 72 not too long ago, so I'm slowly but surely transitioning into retirement. I don't know why, because I still enjoy what I do, but Brandon is taking over slowly but surely, and he's pretty much the brains behind everything now as far as what we do in the shop and things like that, the technologies, I'm like the old dinosaur trying to learn how to turn the computer on yet. he's like miles ahead.
No, you're the guy that you walk by the booth at 4 o'clock on an afternoon and you're taking a sleep in your booth.
Yeah, I have my nap time. Yeah,
I don't know how many times I walked by a Jacoby booth and saw you napping.
So funny, because as we've grown over the years, we used to have the wood shop. It used to be next to Dad's house. It was. So when we had moved from Wisconsin Rapids into Nakusa, we moved the shop into my dad's basement, and then we moved it. Eventually, we built a shop next to his house, and then we moved all the equipment up there. And then eventually we outgrew that, and then we moved into a building in Nakusa on the main business on Market Street. And then we ended up moving some of the equipment back to his house where we would process some of the hybrid shafts. And he'd about 2 o'clock, he'd always say, oh, I got to go back. I got to go home. I got to cut some wood. Here I found out he was just napping. He was sneaking out to take a nap.
Well, it's all that hard work, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we can transition that. But basically, Brandon, you had said before the podcast that you're actually going to start signing the CUSFA pretty soon.
Yeah, so we're working hard on a new line that we want to release this September, October, where we transition out of my dad's signature and where I'm starting to put all the signatures on the CUS.
Yep.
Yeah, so you're kind of transitioning into a – sorry, Dave. You're kind of transitioning into a new era of Jacobi Custom CUS. What does that look like, especially given this kind of new infatuation with carbon fiber that we're all having? And I mean, I'm not questioning that because I have one maple shaft in my case. I got a 4x6 case, and I have 5 carbon fibers, and I have one maple shaft. So I am fully on board with the carbon fiber revolution. But what is the future of Jacobi look like now?
I think we're going to continue to stay the course and stay focused on what the customer wants. So over the years, we've also, I think, done a good job on staying in the market. I think we probably travel more than any other cue maker in the country, where we're constantly at different events talking to players and just staying in touch with what the players want and staying focused on trying to make high-quality products that fit the demands of the pool player. You know, and for myself, it's really important for me that it's something that I can feel comfortable playing with too. So a lot of times when I design product, it's really kind of geared a little bit to my own personal preference, because if I can't play with it, it's hard for me to try and sell it to someone. So I think it's still staying the course with, we're working on different carbon shafts, different diameters, different tapers, different break cues and jump cues. And so we've been working hard on trying to develop some new products to come out in the next few years.
Oh, come on. You got to give us a little bit of a sneak peek here, right?
So I think probably one of the next products, so we're working on a blackout break cue where it has a carbon shaft. And it works really well as a break cue and also as a jump cue. So you can full cue jump, full ball, really easily, really close. And I think you got a chance to use it at the WSBA, the state event in Wisconsin.
I did, yep.
So we've been working hard on that design, tweaking the design and work on the tail end of some of the changes with that. But that's coming along pretty well.
Yeah, and I will say this, when people ask me, you know, what is their best possible break jump cue out there, I try to talk them out of it immediately. Like, I hate the idea of a jump break cue, especially if you're going to be a top end player, because you're kind of getting a cross between what's good at both without really highlighting either of them individually. So the best break jump cues are not the best break cues, and the best break jump cues are not the best jump cues. But I will say that blackout, that is extremely high quality in both of them, to where, you know, I full length jump cue, that thing jumps better than any cue I've ever hit with. And you, if I'm not mistaken, the jump cue part of it is 2 inches longer than what a quote unquote standard jump cue is. It's a little bit longer, right?
It is. And over the years, that's why I've stayed away from selling break jump cues. I've done them on request for people, but typically I don't like building break jump cues, because just like you said, they're two different shots. One, it'd be like in golf, if you took your putter and you would try and drive with it, it's a different shot. You wouldn't use your same thing in pool. The jump shot is different than the break cue. So usually you lose a little of both. So A lot of times you'll lose a little of the braking, but it jumps okay, or it jumps really good, but you know, so you always lose a little bit. And this is the first time that I feel really confident that it does both exceptionally well. And I think, and a big part of that is the technology with the carbon shaft. You can gain a lot of stiffness with a reduction in weight. With wood shafts, you have to modify the tapers to get the stiffness. But with the carbon shafts, it's really the layup of the material. So you can alter that by the thickness and the way the material lays, you know, what densities of foams you use in the centers. So that really changes everything about that cue. And that cue does break really well, and it jumps extremely well. It does both really well.
It does.
You and I can jump with it.
And that is saying a lot, because that's saying a lot.
For anybody who knows Dave, knows that that's probably true.
Yep.
So, yeah, but the Blackout isn't available yet, but it is hopefully going to be in the near future sometime, you know, maybe by the end. It doesn't matter. It'll be available sometime soon. You definitely want to probably try to check that out, especially if you do like the idea of having a jump brake combination. It does best of both worlds, like very, very few jump brakes do. So I can echo that. You let me use it for about a week and a half, and it was great. It did hit the balls really, really good. Okay, so that pretty much gives a pretty good idea on Jacobi Custom Cues as a company and kind of the aim, you know, how you got to where you are and your direction in the future. There is one more thing that I wanted to cover, because I think it's kind of a really cool thing that you guys did with this kind of lockdown and stuff, where you guys actually basically cut just about all of your margins and were basically giving out cues to different companies to be able to raise money to basically keep their doors open. So, you know, I did, I think four raffles that I did to raise some money for the local pool rooms. And, you know, I even worked with a couple of other people that did their own for their individual pool rooms as well. And I think that is one thing that you guys, you know, that's a really cool thing about you guys as a company, that you guys would, you know, kind of, you know, take a little bit less, well, significantly less margins on your cues so that you could help the community in Wisconsin. And I think that that's something that's kind of unique to, maybe not unique to Wisconsin Pool, but is definitely prevalent in Wisconsin Pool, where the big entities in Wisconsin try to take care of each other, and they try to, you know, really make it so everybody can eat. So I would like you to talk about a little bit about that, what your thought process was in doing that, and maybe why you did it.
Well, I would like to say that, Nate, it was really, you spearheaded a lot of it, and I'm really thankful that, you know, everyone who reached out and that we were able to network together and do something that was beneficial. We've always tried to support as much as we can pool in general over the years, whether it's been different tournaments that people have, you know, contacted us about giving cues for that, or you know, getting product that they could use to raise money to add to the tournaments. You know, we've always supported all of our state associations, all of our league systems around town and in central Wisconsin, and you know, we're out and about, and we have so many friends within the community, and the billiard industry is a pretty tight-knit group. You know, we see a lot of the same players all around the country, and have made a lot of good friendships over the years. And it's been really good to always try and give back. So we've worked hard on that.
Dave, did you want to add anything?
No, that kind of sums it up pretty good. I agree. And my philosophy has always been, if you don't have people playing pool, there's no need for pool cues. So the more you can support the industry and the more people you can get to play pool, the better off everything is for the whole billiard industry.
Yeah, well said. And I definitely wanted to highlight that, because that's something that's, you know, that's a pretty cool thing that you guys did. And you guys gave the opportunity for a lot of places to, you know, you're not paying their mortgages or anything like that, but you're raising some serious coinage to be able to really help them through some of these times. So the margins in pool are already pretty small, especially if you're a pool hall owner. So doing that and offering that up and, helping them out is it's a pretty admirable thing. And I think it needed to get highlighted. So if we, you know, if anybody's listening out here, you know, if you're a cue maker or whatever, try to help out the people that you can, for sure, especially, you know, especially if you have the ability to, when it comes to times like this. So I think that that needed to get highlighted.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate that, Nate.
Yeah. And I guess with that, that pretty much really wraps up this interview. I really appreciated you guys joining, and I know we've been trying to get this to happen for a little while now, and you know, that Dave, you just can't keep him awake long enough to be able to interview him, but, you know.
Hey, wait a minute. Sometimes I'm awake.
We loaded him up with coffee all day long for this moment. But no, it's been an absolute pleasure, guys. And, you know, Brandon, we'll keep in touch. You know, we always have our, you know, bi-daily, you know, telephone call. So, you know, well, I'm sure we'll keep that up.
Yep. Nope. That sounds great.
And, Dave, I thank you very much for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Take care, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thanks a lot, Nate. Mm-hmm.